Hi, I'm Tom Power. Welcome to Toy Harp, a podcast about bluegrass. This is the last episode of season two. Here from Nashville is my conversation with Allison Krauss.
I remember, you know, the first time I looked out in the audience and saw people singing words to our songs that only we had recorded. That was just a really crazy moment. Just never thought it'd end up being there. Never thought we'd hear back from Rounder. Yeah. Never thought we would hear from Rounder in the first place.
If this is your first time listening, you can hear full interviews with Jerry Douglas, Allison Brown, Bela Fleck, Larry Sparks, Jody Stecker, and so many more wherever you get your podcast. Thank you so much for listening. Later on.
Oh, hello, and welcome to Basic Folk, where we have honest conversations with folk musicians. It's Cindy Howes. Thank you so much for finding us. Great to have you. Before we get into today's guest, Sam Phillips, let's talk about our newsletter. We are a podcast that sends out a monthly newsletter, if you can believe it or not. Sign up for the newsletter at our website, basicfolk.com. You can click on the red sign up for Basic Folk newsletter button. There's also a link in the show notes to sign up. You can also follow us on social media. We're at Basic Folk Pod on most of the social platforms. We are also a listener-funded operation. If you've been listening for a while and know we're a listener-funded operation but haven't made a contribution, now could be the time to do it. You can make your donation at basicfolk.com/donate. If you want to do none of those things and just listen, that is also fine. You could also, if you want to, you could also tell a friend, tell your folk friends about this podcast. I think they'd love it. All right, let's get to Sam. Sam Phillips was born to a family that loved doling out nicknames. She was called Sam growing up in a house that was filled with readers. She nurtured her love of philosophy and spirituality by exploring different religions and devouring works by authors like C.S. Lewis and Thomas Merton. Early in her musical career, she found success as a Christian musician under her real name, Leslie Phillips. She made several albums, but became uncomfortable with her label marketing her as the Christian Cyndi Lauper. She also had a desire to write songs that didn't reinforce people's religious beliefs. For her final Leslie Phillips album, she worked with future spouse, ex-spouse T-Bone Burnett, a fellow Christian with a maverick approach to songs about faith and morality and a found kindred spirit. She decided to rebrand and started recording as Sam Phillips. Sam and T-Bone worked together from 1988's The Indescribable Wow to 2004's A Boot and a Shoe. In our conversation, we talk about Sam's writing process, which she's always changing up. She comes up with her best ideas when she turns off the trying part of her brain, but at the same time, she strongly believes in the power of editing. Sam's probably best known for composing and performing the score for the beloved Amy Sherman Palladino series, The Gilmore Girls, for which she also made a brief appearance on the season finale in 2006. You remember those la-la-las while Lorelai and Rory carried around their armpit purses, drank coffee while wearing those horrible bootcut jeans? That was Sam Phillips. Currently, Sam is working on a new album, and she's taking her time, so don't rush her, okay? Right now, we're going to listen to her latest song. It's Too Many Light Years From You to Here, and then we'll get to our conversation with one of my faves, Sam Phillips, on Basic Folk.
I can't lose my mind if I give it away, so why don't you take it? Too many thoughts of you, just make it yours anyway. I'm lost in the cosmos, looking for re-entry, trying to escape myself. Though I love my gravity, my own human depravity makes me long for a world somewhere else. Lost in the cosmos, tired of the future, where everything moves so fast. So much hard traveling, big spin unraveling, where you and I never got to make our past. Lost in the cosmos, you can find me behind.
Sam Phillips, thank you so much for talking to me and being on Basic Folk.
Thank you so much for having me. I think I'm both basic and a folk. So I hope I met the requirements. The application was lengthy, but I hope you guys will accept my application.
You were born in Glendale, California as Leslie Phillips.
Actually, I was born in Los Angeles proper. And I want to punch my hip card here. So I was actually born in what is now known as Silver Lake.
Oh, my gosh. An original.
Isn't that funny?
Silver Lakeian.
Yeah. It's a hospital that is now called the Dream Center that I think is actually maybe a rehab or something. That towers above the freeways. Yes.
Wow. Well, that's cool. You were given the nickname Sam. And as I understand it, everyone had a nickname in your family. In fact, several nicknames. And my wife's family is the same, whereas there are like 3 to 4 nicknames for each person. And trying to find somebody in a phone, like for the contacts, is like near impossible, which sets a certain tone. How do you think all the nicknames impacted the vibe of your house and how you related to one another?
I think it was always lighthearted and fun. And I think, as I've said before, you know, we were talking about pets and all the pets had, you know, abbreviated nicknames and they kept changing. You know, nobody really had a name for really that long because, you know, people do change. So my child has many as well.
What are some of the best nicknames in your family?
The best or the strangest? Because we had a, I guess my dog Kiki, her nickname, my dad called her Kicker Beaker. So you know how you riff. It's like jazz. You just riff on these nicknames and they get longer or shorter. And I probably never should have said that. I shouldn't have divulged that family secret. But now you know it's out here. It's out in the public, a Basic Folk show.
Great. I'm hoping to get many secrets from you today.
Oh, you know what? I might have to make some up to entertain.
Do you see that nickname effect showing up for you as an adult, as a parent, that kind of silliness?
Yes, I think, when did I realize this? But I remember thinking, how do you become okay? How do you become a whole person? How do you become an adult? And I think at one point I realized, or what's a good person? And aside from, yes, the basic love and respect, I think the people that you want to be around and the person that you want to be is somebody that's funny, that's lighthearted, that brings, makes people laugh. And that's being close to somebody. I think there's nothing maybe more intimate than sense of humor, being able to share a sense of humor. And it's also a sense of intelligence, comfort. You know, I think I can't say enough about a sense of humor. I think it's a real, really important subtlety, or maybe not so subtle thing in a relationship.
Mm. Yes, there is an ease to having a sense of humor, and it's a great defense mechanism, I find.
It can be that. That's true. That's true.
Yes. Can you describe the music scene in your family growing up? Who was listening to what? Who was playing what? And where did you find the good stuff?
I found some good stuff. I had to dig. My parents weren't very musical at all, although my grandparents were. My grandmother in the 1920s used to, she would play the pump organ at church, and she was a very tiny, very slight lady. And, you know, if you know anything about a pump organ, you have to really work it with your feet to be able to get any sound out of it. And so she would do that for like an hour and a half throughout the whole church service. And then she was always really good at parties with her friends, playing all the jazz and the songs of the day, playing those on piano. So there is a little bit of music there, but really in my house, my parents had Nat King Cole and jazz records and some, you know, Broadway musicals, but it was very, very slight. Although they did like the Tijuana Brass, Herb Alpert's, you know, series. And what I did learn from those records were a lot of standards that I had never heard anywhere else. You know, they weren't on the popular radio back in the day, but I heard those melodies, and I think that those melodies were influential. But, you know, so were commercials on television and all the Disney the Sherman Brothers, all those Disney classic films that they scored or that they wrote songs for, you know, like Mary Poppins and the Jungle Book. So I feel like as a child, a lot went in, including the Beatles, my brother's Led Zeppelin records. You know, there's just a whole lot of stuff that went in.
I was at a bar last night that was playing like a satellite radio station of classic rock. My wife has a nephew who is like 15 years old, and he only listens to like stuff from the 70s and 80s. And it's just, there's like something about that kind of like Beatles, Led Zeppelin sound that I don't know what it is. If you have that perspective at all, that like that particular era so resonates with being a teenager and being angsty.
Yeah, and I find even listening to it now, listening to David Bowie or some of the glam rock of that era, it's got a, I don't know if rebellion is such a clunky word, but it does have the greatest pushback, the greatest attitude, questioning attitude, you know, and I love that about music and some songwriters, like even like Tom Waits. I had a song, you know, he took the trite old saying, you can't take it with you, and spit back, I'm going to take it with me when I go, you know, and yeah, wrote all these, all those things that on Mule Variations, all those things that he was going to take with him, you know, when he goes. And I love that, turning something on its side, giving it a different perspective. There was a lot of that. And I still hear that, and I'm glad that those kids are listening to that kind of music. I know a lot of kids about that age who, as well, who are listening to that kind of stuff. And I hope that there will be more pushback in a good way, in an interesting way, in a funny way. You know, not just people trying to reach some kind of a perfection. Because, you know, a lot of songwriters that I was coming up with, they either wanted to be Bob Dylan or Joni Mitchell. And I felt, when I heard Bob Dylan, I felt like quitting because he just covered so much and he was so great. But then I also knew that I could say it in a different way. There was something, mm-hmm. even if it just a few words, even if just one or two songs, I knew that I could get something in there that hadn't been said maybe quite the way I could say it. And that's about the only songwriting lesson I think I could give to anybody other than just paying attention to really great melodies and great lyrics.
Mm. More on melody later, because I hear you're a melody person, as am I. Your family were avid readers in the house growing up, and it sounds like some heavy material was passed around. You got your hands on some philosophy books and spirituality books.
Yeah, I was, you know, maybe the other segment of the population in the 70s, you know, that we don't hear about, early 70s, you know, a lot of drugs, sex, and rock and roll, but I think there were a lot of people exploring spirituality in those days, too, and I was really interested in all of that, and you know, the things that we can't see, things beyond us, you know, what is the spiritual realm. And so I was more interested in that as a kid, and I didn't experiment with drugs, but I did experiment with a lot of different religion and philosophies and things, kind of too long to go into, but some almost even Jungian experiments that I was just a young kid and didn't know what I was doing, but saw some odd things that I still to this day can't explain.
How close were you to joining a cult?
If you would say that fundamentalist Christianity was a cult, I guess you could say that I joined it so for a while, because I did start out in the church. My mom and my grandmother were Presbyterians, and I grew up in the Presbyterian church, but then there were hippie churches popping up all over Southern California with a lot of folk music and you know, surfer church, and so I frequented some of those, and you know, basically learned a lot of the same things I learned about people there in the church that I did later on in yoga class or you know, some of the different disciplines, you know, the different spiritual disciplines that I came in contact with. There was a basic, you know, human thing that you can either be judgmental and always be right, Or you can be loving and kind and open, and it's just kind of, it's basically that, I think, pretty much across the board.
Hmm. The spirituality that you were experimenting with, was it mainly Christianity?
It was later on in my life when I was really young. I was fascinated with, you know, magic and the occult, but quickly kind of got into the church and sort of bumped around in there for a while.
Do you remember why you became so infatuated with spirituality and how you relate to that sort of ground zero for your infatuation?
I mean, my best guess is that I was, you know, an imaginative kid and a sensitive kid. Also, you know, my family wasn't the most happy, stable family. My parents did stay together and raise their kids, but it was, you know, there were a lot of issues. It was far from perfect. So, you know, perhaps that drove me to, you know, look for some love, truth, you know, outside of my family. But I think it really just questioning and curious and wanting to explore all that for some reason. I think, you know, it's funny because my younger sister had no interest in that stuff. My brother was mildly interested, but so I don't know. I think it might have just been me.
Would you say you're the most curious out of all your siblings?
You know, I don't know that for sure. I mean, both of them are very intelligent people. So I don't want to say that. I was the middle child,
right?
Too. So I kind of, you know, I love them both. They're very, very different from me. I will say
right.
that. So they, perhaps their questions were different questions from mine.
Right. Can you talk about why you started writing songs and if the reason still rings true for you now as a songwriter?
Yeah, I think it was, I started dancing at three. I took dance lessons. And so my what that did, I think, for me was really strengthen my sense of rhythm and melody and musical expression. Because, you know, music, if you're a drummer, that's a very physical activity to play the drums. And actually, I think that singing is too. You know, some people are more athletic and have bigger gifts, certainly, than I do. And they work out a lot more. They push their voices a lot more, and take care of their voices a lot more. But I think that was one thing that started me off being really interested in music. But then there was that era that was in the classic singer-songwriter era. People wanted to say things in their songs. They wanted to express themselves, express truth. We actually had a little library close to where I grew up that you could check records, vinyl, out of. And you could take them home play them and then take them back, which was so cool for a kid who, you know,
Must have been amazing.
Yeah, didn't have a job and couldn't. And so I found Randy Newman and a lot of different great records that way that I never would have been able to afford to buy, yeah, and wouldn't have known to buy either.
Hmm. There's kind of two questions in this question. So when you were 14, you would attend Pentecostal meetings. So I'm wondering what they were like. Was music involved? And then the second part of this question, I really should have separated them into two, but how did you choose music to express your spirituality, express your faith?
Well, the first thing is I didn't really frequent. I mean, I went to a couple of Pentecostal meetings that were crazy theater. You know, they were really nutty. There was one near my home that I walked to because I was probably about 12. And I remember that all the women had on those long 70s dresses and they all had beehive hairdos. And I remember, you know, sitting down to this very nice lady, and I didn't mean to be an upstart, but I just said to her, well, is the beehive hairdo, is that connected to what you believe? You know, is this part of the Pentecostalism? And she did get kind of offended and just, you know, said no. But it really was. They all really did look alike, and the antics were quite. There were no snakes or anything like that. But it was a show. Mm-hmm. It was a crazy show. And I marveled at it. I had never seen anything like that. I of course didn't feel that I could relate to it or that I wanted to be a part of it. So I did find, like I said, something that was a little bit more in the world that I was in. You know, the surfer church, you know, kids that were my own age that were listening to folk music or rock music. And there were rock bands and folk musicians that were, you know, talking about God. So it wasn't a completely weird thing to get into. But that's... You know, basically, I think the culture at that time, it was very much like what was on the radio. So it was not a big stretch. It was interesting to find that and to feel like maybe the music was saying something a little bit more than, you know, let's make love in my Chevy van or whatever, you know, afternoon delight, whatever the, you know, it was happening and all the insane, you know, pop hits of that era.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And then the second part of that question was about choosing music as an expression of your faith and becoming a Christian musician. How did you choose music?
I think inherently I knew this. I mean, I was pressured myself to be very to toe the line and say just tout the party line, I guess you'd say. But I think that music also, I did know of some musicians and some writers that were approaching Christianity or spirituality in a much more subtle and imaginative way with metaphor. Mm-hmm. And that's what I loved about the Bible, frankly. There's so much metaphor. And I really, from an early age, learned to think that way all the time, to see metaphor in nature and in situations. And I think music was closer to a language that could express spirituality, you know. For instance, I was listening to Avo Part, this wonderful composer, a classical modern composer, and this piece the other day, it was this beautiful piece with strings in a minor key, and all of the strings are just over and over, they're descending, almost like a waterfall. And there was some kind of grief in that I heard or that I felt in the music, but it was interesting because it wasn't like a lot of times you hear a song and you know the singer is talking about something and you understand that was when I got my heart broken or when I lost somebody. You know, there are all kinds of ways you could relate to a song, but this was interesting because I felt like I couldn't really connect it to any personal grief. I felt like because it was such a big and beautiful composition, I felt the music was talking about something, a larger kind of grief, like for the planet or for mankind or for animals. It was just a really big grief. And I thought, how interesting that music can do that. It can really, in its own language, make you feel something or think about something that's not even... you know, that you can't even really articulate. And so I think that music and spirituality do have that in common, that it's music can articulate things that that are very hard to articulate, or that, you know, I think that a lot of Christians do very badly, I guess I'll just say it. It's just, you know, there's a lot of judgment and then a lot of, you know, sayings that are just worn into the ground. It's just like all of us, you know, we're afraid.
Yeah.
We get into a comfortable place and we want to, you know, we want to be right. We want to talk about the things that make other people like us, or, you know, we fit in, you know, all that stuff.
This is a good place to talk about melody. As a writer, you say, I'm very attracted to melodies. It's the ecstatic part of music. If you can ride on that melody with your lyrics, that can be very powerful. So in thinking about what you just said, and also about your scoring television, what is it like for you to communicate through just melody versus having lyrics? And with scoring television, how did that realization of communication through melody change your writing?
I guess it did change my writing, but I think it was a great relief not to always have to find lyrics that would match the melody or say what, or try to say what the melody I felt was saying. That it was, I always, that's the hardest thing for me, I think, with it. It's a lot easier to take a lyric and just put it to music, to find the music for it, rather than trying to interpret what the music is saying. So what I did like about, you know, scoring the Gilmore Girls in that I started in 2000, I'd never done any composing before, and when we started, the show was so dialogue heavy that the creator said, or the EP said, you know, I think no lyrics, just melodies. Can you just kind of sing? Can we just have your voice? And so,
how like bold to say to a singer songwriter, no lyrics?
Yeah, well, yeah, I know. Only Amy Sherman-Palladino. I love it, but right. She was right. And also, we didn't have much time. I had to condense the melodies to be able to just, you know, because to get from one scene to another, it's seconds. And so to actually have a melody that starts and doesn't just drop off, or doesn't end abruptly, it was, you know, I had to simplify. And all, because the other thing is, a lot of times score can be just rhythmic or can be very, very plain and unemotional. But I felt that there were some emotional moments that needed to be played up with something a little darker, sadder, something a little lighter. So it was a challenge to be able to express in that short amount of time, to be able to express those emotions and to really help the picture, you know, not hurt it.
Mm. Mm. In thinking about your songwriting, you say that you come up with great ideas while walking or driving. First of all, I want to give credit to the podcast Carol Pop. You were on there talking about,
yes,
your songwriting process and breaking it down. It was really, really interesting to listen to. So you are talking about coming up with great ideas while you're basically turning off the trying part of your brain. But you also strongly believe in editing. So I imagine there's like a pretty big juxtaposition happening inside your head with those two combating aspects of your writing process.
Yes. And I hit the wall constantly, you know, with that, because sometimes I can't get much out before the editor's already screaming in my ear. So that's important to, you know, you got to keep that, guy in check. And be free. But then, you know, a lot of times the melody, the idea will be so stubborn. I've had songs that I've been working on for years. They just little pieces that won't go away that I've finally, and I still have some, but that I, you know, will turn into songs years later. So it's not easy to let go, but I do believe in that editor. I think that editor is really important. And I felt that very strongly when I listened to a demo that I had started. I'd started just freeform writing on a cassette tape, writing a song that I wrote in the 90s called I Need Love. And it was interesting to hear where that started and then where it ended up. And where it started was not, you know, if I just thought, oh yeah, I don't need an editor. I can just, anything I do is really great. I'm just going to, you know, I'm going to throw that down, put that on, you know, let's cut it. It took me a long time to write that song, but I'm so glad that I took the time, because I felt that it really went to a whole other place. It wasn't the song I Need Love when I started it, even though it was the idea that led me to that. So I think that's important to keep, to not be lazy, to keep going. If you think you can make it a little bit better, and to keep listening to your idea, is it good enough? Is there something you can do to make it better? You know, but all of this is just so subjective and, you know, not easy. And it's become a little bit easier with experience, but I'm still, you know, I'm still, trying to find my way in the dark, I think.
As a Christian musician back in the 80s, I get the sense that you were pretty uncomfortable, especially towards the end of your Leslie Phillips recording days, where the label was calling you the Christian Cyndi Lauper and you wanted to write songs that didn't reinforce people's religious beliefs. So how did that experience change your relationship to reinvention and being okay with certain types of uncomfortable, like living outside the Christian music industry?
Yeah, it was, I think I just became more and more interested in growing as a songwriter, in growing as a person. And I think in any form of show business, there is always a temptation to just do the same thing that gets you applause. Just do that over and over again. Don't take any risks. So it was very similar, except that it was my spiritual life and my whole life as well as music. And there was a lot of, you know, at that point, it was very odd and interesting that it was all very uptight in terms of sexuality. All of that stuff was just, you know, at the boiling point with a lid that everyone was trying to hold on it. And that was kind of interesting. And that got tiresome, you know, because it was just such a, people were so judgmental and suspicious and not honest, and as a result, not very free or very loving, you know. And I'm not saying everybody. There were a lot of amazing people that I met during that time that are still wonderful. But it just got your show business depended on whether or not you ever made a mistake or whether or not you ever slept with anyone you weren't married to. It just got to be a little too much, right? That was in my record contract at the time, which is really funny. You can't do anything illegal or immoral. I mean, define immorality, you know.
According to who.
It's not an easy one. But it was easy to break my contract because I just said, well, you know what? I've slept with somebody that I wasn't married to. And if you don't let me out of my contract, I'll tell everyone. And so they said, okay, fine. You're free to go.
How was your faith impacted by that whole experience?
I think my faith in people was impacted. I felt I had a true north, as someone would say. I had my own criteria for what a good person was, for being connected to God, to love, you know, to that energy outside myself. I felt very comfortable with that still, but I felt very uncomfortable with the people and the way that somehow faith had, and the culture had warped people's idea of love, of respect, of boundaries. You know, that was a big one. A lot of people felt empowered to say, tell anyone what they thought they should do. I saw a lot of that, and they certainly didn't have the good sense most of the time or the authority at any time to tell anyone how they should live their life or what they should do. But anyway, we're getting sidetracked on all this. I should write a book about it.
Right. Yes. Yeah. We await your book about this experience.
Yeah. I'm
yes.
not sure anyone would want to read it, but I learned a lot about, again, like I said, I learned a lot about human nature and about people and you know, how we all trip up and how to keep your eyes open and not fall into those terrible traps of judgmentalism and envy. I think a lot of times people were envious or jealous and didn't deal with that. So then it came out as you're going to hell. Which is pretty.
So, yeah.
Wow.
It's like
okay.
the easy go-to. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. You could have thought about that a little more. You know, we don't have to go straight to hell. We could take a little side trip to self-realization maybe and then see about the hell part.
For your final Leslie Phillips album, you started working with your future ex-spouse, T-Bone Burnett, who was a fellow Christian with a maverick approach to songs about faith and morality, and you found a kindred spirit in T-Bone. And I kind of want to hear more about you being a maverick, like what it's been like to lean into that rebellious identity throughout your life.
I I didn't really think of it as rebellion. I just felt that I had to, I was suffocating, and I felt that I had to get out and breathe and be who I was. And so I was just trying to get better as an artist and grow and take in more experiences and more literature and visual art and music. I just wanted to expand and break open my world and to let all of this wonderful stuff in. Because I think that there, because mm-hmm. of a lot of fear and fundamentalism, there's a shutting out of things that maybe aren't approved. And, you know, just like I said about the, you know, the ladies at the Pentecostal meeting with the beehives, obviously they were afraid to have any other hairstyle or any other style
right.
style, you know, because, and
right.
isn't that so funny? And it's, and I'm glad I actually ignorantly asked that lady if it was part of the religion, because it's a good question.
Mm-hmm.
Why are you mm-hmm. all expressing the same thing? And I think a lot of times it's human nature to all want to fit in, but also, you know, to being afraid of being rejected. And I felt that instead of being afraid that that Christian audience would reject me, I really felt I had a responsibility to the people that were listening to me at that time that really actually came out of that world with me. And I felt I wanted them to trust me. I felt badly that sometimes I had, you know, I was very young when I started. I was, you know, in my teens and very young making records. And I think I'd said things that were not thought through, you know, because I was a kid and, you know, and people were looking to me for answers. And so what do you do? Sometimes you just try to make up the best answer that you can. And mm-hmm. I didn't want to do that anymore. I wanted to stop answering the questions or stop giving answers if that's what I had to do to be more truthful and to find the answers for myself. And then let the music and the lyrics and my life, you know, let it all radiate out from there.
You became Sam Phillips, musically speaking, in 1988, and your music career throughout the 90s was very of the time, like pop sounding. And you said being a solo female artist was not easy in the pop world. I don't think I was meant to be a pop person in that way, which I read as you talking about being like a popular face forward, my name is on the album cover type of musician. But what does that mean to you?
Oh, well, I think a pop star, a celebrity, I guess. I was, you know, it's funny because during that time, I did. I had a lot of acquaintances that were very well known, and one in particular I'm thinking of, who I adore, who's really such an extrovert. But when we would go out in public with this person, and they would get a lot of attention, and you know, it would be nerve wracking to me because my maternal thing would kick in. I'd want to protect them, you know, not like get away, people, you know, stay away. But when that person, which is so ridiculous because that person's an extrovert and a performer and feeds on it, you know, loves that attention, lives on that, thrives on it, you know. But I found all of that stuff, you know, to be kind of nerve wracking. And also, you know, I always felt that if a person's a good person and an interesting person, they're going to be that no matter if they're famous or not. I think sometimes people dream of going to a party with all their favorite famous people. And, you know, sometimes those parties can be drab. They aren't exactly the most interesting parties unless, you know, of course, somebody's really smashed and is taking a hammer to the room or something. You know, there are those things. But I just don't think being famous, I don't think makes you interesting. I think you are interesting or you're not. That's how I see it.
After working on Gilmore Girls, you said, I found I was more comfortable behind the camera. Songwriting really has my heart, not singing. And I want to know more about how you feel about performing. I recall seeing you live. It remains like one of my favorite live moments where you're performing live with this crack band. And in between songs, you say to the audience, we need to talk about the encore. And then you asked, do you want one? And everyone's like, yeah. And then that was like halfway through the show. And then you were like, okay, this is the encore. And you played the song and you left the stage. And I'm like, that was brilliant.
Yeah, there's always room for improvement. You know, I think we were coming to the end of that. I think we're still sort of at the end of that thing. And especially when we're talking about, you know, in folk circles and Americana music, I think there's a tendency. I like tradition, and I know that the audience feels comfortable doing a certain thing. But I also think, you know, what the audience is really comfortable with is when you have the wheel. You know, if you can feel the hecklers and just you can keep the wheel in your hands the whole time, you know, so that they don't feel like everything's out of control, I think. But then you can also, you know, drive off the pavement a little bit and go off road and, you know, take them to a, you know, another place. I think that's also, that's a good thing. A few surprises. I think looking back, I wish I'd been much more, you know, gotten much more into the theatrical part of it than I did performing. But, you know, but that's, there are those that are coming up that I think are going to be doing that brilliantly. So I think there's a lot more theater in there. There's a lot more of a combination these days. I think that's what makes me really excited and hopeful that there's an amalgamation of all these different disciplines, you know, dance, theater, poetry, music, you know, sometimes even politics or, you know, causes. You know, there are a lot of good things happening out there.
Mm. I read this interview with Amy Sherman Palladino. It's a 12-year-old interview, but she was talking about you mainly in the interview, so I'm not sure if you have read this or not. But for those who haven't, Amy is a huge fan of your singing. She says her voice might be my most favorite female voice ever. It's kind of like what? Joan Didion's writing to me. It's a little haunted. It's a little step back from it. So it sort of creates this mood and tone. I just love her voice. So, Sam, what do you think of your voice, and how has that relationship changed over your career?
Well, first of all, thank you for reading that. I had never read that before, and I guess in some ways, lucky for her, she liked it, right? Because it was a lot of, somebody actually said to me, oh my God, my daughter watches this show called The Gilmore Girls, and there's this music, la, la, la. Oh, it's so annoying. And he had no idea it was me. And I thought that was just fantastic. And probably my greatest moment would be if there was ever an SNL skit with somebody making fun of the Lalas. I know Gilmore Girls, the name has been dropped, you know, in some of their sketches, but I think, yeah, my voice is it. I've learned to do the best I can with it. It has frustrated me. I've always felt that I was, you know, two people, the songwriter and the singer. And a lot of times as a songwriter, I was very frustrated with the singer that the singer couldn't do what I wanted her to do, in terms of the melody, pulling off the melody. But I do think that the things that I love about singing, tone and phrasing, I think that I do have something that's a little more, and also a unique sound. There are a lot of amazingly talented people out there, especially these days. And I think that the contest shows sort of raise the bar in terms of singing, or at least the pyrotechnics of singing and the drama of singing. It kind of that came to the forefront. But, you know, I don't hear as many just completely unique singers, because I think it is a combination of things. It is your intonation and it is your tone, but it's also phrasing. It's really important to phrase well. And to get all of that going, I think all I did was I just listened to the Beatles a lot, and I loved their harmonies, and I just wanted to sing like all four of them at once, you know, if I could just have all four of their voices.
The dream, right?
In my pipes, and that came out, that would be, yeah, that would kind of be my dream, which I'm sure not that many wonderful singers are ever thinking. But I do, you know, I think I've sort of made peace with it. I have this child who is immensely talented, has an amazing instrument. And it was very interesting having to, watch that develop and watch my child work on that, you know, and really, really take singing lessons and use it and further it and take it so seriously and go to art school and just, you know, all this stuff when I just barely, you know, croak out a song. But it was interesting because they said, one time I said, oh, you're watching the Gilmore Girls. Oh, my God. And they said, yeah, because, you know, the sound of your voice is comforting to me. And I thought, well, okay, mm-hmm. If nobody else, then that made me really happy. I know that they are pushing away from anything that their dad has done, anything that I have done to make their own mark, which I so respect and admire and love. But, you know, at the same time, it's nice to know that there's that connection there, that there's that appreciation, even though they want to run, you know, like hell in the other direction, which I don't, you know, is all a part of a good spirit, I think, a good, you know, backbone.
Now that your child is a grown-up, how do they inspire or impact your musicality, and how do you relate to them as a musician?
I hesitate to say too much because I know this is going to sound really, boy, like some a dumb mom, but I am a huge fan. And I don't even really want to mention their name because I want them to find their own audience. And I think that my audience, if they find them, it'll be great. But I'm astounded by the writing and the things that are coming. And this is just happening now. They are just coming out into the world. So I kind of hate to, I don't want to jinx it or mention it, but I'm constantly inspired and hopeful because I think that they are taking the all that they've been raised with. And it's funny because they heard a lot of music growing up, but at 14, it's like a switch flipped and they went deep into all kinds of music, into hardcore punk, into the avant-garde, you know, Frank Zappa, jazz, just everything, just like this hunger, this thirst had been activated in them. And they know so much more about music than I do. It's the same way, I think, with a lot of literature and poetry. I find, you know, these things that I like, I'm a very specific person that goes deep. My child, grown-up child, has all this knowledge of music and has retained it and is really just putting all that together into their own sound. So the way I relate to it is just complete awe and joy, because the other thing was, it was never a plan. T-Bone nor I ever had a plan of trying to push that person into show business, you know, or anything. In fact, I think we were hoping for something, you know, like brain surgery or, you know, something. But of course, you know, they are a beautiful, creative person. So more on that soon, I hope. Maybe they will visit the Basic Folk Show at one point.
Right.
I hope so, because I think you'd have fun with them.
Yeah, they're certainly welcome. Your husband, the string player and arranger Eric Gorfain of the Section Quartet, he's been working with you since 1994, but most intensely on the last three or four albums. So you just went through a pandemic together working on your new album.
Yeah.
How has Eric's involvement in the work changed your perspective on strings as a form of expression in your songs?
Well, first of all, I don't want to get in trouble with anyone, so I'm going to say that I've known him since 2004, not 1994. But
somewhere online, it says he was on your 94 album.
Oh, well, we did.
It might be on his Wikipedia album.
You know what may be confusing is I did a vinyl, because I don't think Martinis and Bikinis did not come out on vinyl. So I actually did a vinyl of that and added a few songs to it, that redos of some of the songs, and Eric played on that. So he played on a reissue of Martinis and Bikinis.
Okay, I'm glad
that has
glad
extra
we figured
tracks.
That out.
Yeah, that's probably.
I do not want anyone to get in trouble.
Yeah, but yeah, he's a wonderful musician, and Eric loves to listen and push himself as an arranger, as a musician. It's interesting. I watch people in the classical world, and it's very cutthroat, very ambitious, and there are only so many sessions, jobs, And, you know, they're all vying for those, you know, those sessions, those A-list jobs. And I've watched him, though he loves playing and he plays live all the time, he has fallen in love with arranging. And also he engineers, he's done some producing. So it's an interesting thing about him. He's just so in love with music and being able to do a lot of different things, not just be a violinist. And, you know, it's pretty nice to be holed up with someone that you like that can arrange strings. It's been fun to be able to sit down with him and sing him lines or collaborate on different ideas. Whereas as much as I loved and do adore him, you know, working with Van Dyke Parks, you know, Van Dyke, you give him the song, he gives you the arrangements. There aren't many notes. You know, usually you don't have many notes for Van Dyke because he's so fantastic. But, you know, there isn't as much time to collaborate when you're on the clock like that. So I guess being off the clock, especially really being off the clock during the pandemic, gave us a lot of time to have some fun with strings. And, you know, I'm taking my time with it because the trap is, okay, Eric, here's a song. He does this beautiful arrangement. And it's, you know, I think, well, is it the arrangement that's making the song okay? Or is it not a good song with a good arrangement, you know, or is it an okay song? So it's you know, hearing those strings is just, it's very seductive and they're really beautiful. And sometimes it just makes it sound, maybe things sound better than they are in terms of the songwriting, honestly. And so there's one song that I've had to throw out, and sadly, because I just felt like, it's just the string arrangement was so beautiful, but I don't think the song was really as good as it, you know, as the string arrangement. So that's
the strings are manipulation.
They are, yeah. They in the best way. But it's also fun to see what the strings can do. I remember one of my friends, Patrick Warren, who's also a wonderful string arranger and keyboard player. And I asked him once, I just said, you know, what can strings do? And he said, anything. Just, you know, anything you can imagine. And I love that. I loved that kind of attitude. Now, of course, my songs are, you know, not going to allow them to do anything, but I think it's really lovely and beautiful. So I can't wait to finish it and send it out to the world.
Right. I won't ask you the question of when it's going to be out.
Yeah. I don't know. I'm really bad at that. Yeah, I could say, okay, you know, in 6 months, and then it could take another 6 months, or it could be even sooner than that, but I doubt it. So we'll give it 6 months and change. Or you know, a year and change.
Before we end, can we do a lightning round?
Okay. Is this just like a whatever comes to mind, or is this actually
yes,
answering questions?
Answering questions.
Uh-oh. Okay.
With lightning speed.
With,
okay,
I mean,
Sam,
like,
Phillips.
Facts and things I'm supposed to know.
Facts and feelings.
Okay. Okay, just so long as as long as there are feelings and maybe even dogs in there, I'll do okay.
I just heard mine bark in the basement.
Aw. Please don't tell your dog that he's down there because of me. Just say
I
you're
won't.
Just tell him you were interviewing Tori Amos or something, you know, somebody else.
Okay. She hates Tori Amos.
I hope not, but I just anybody
no.
else. Just not Auntie Sam.
Right. Okay, here we go.
Okay.
What is a song that makes you cry every time?
Marie by Randy Newman. Or that's the first one that came to mind. There are a lot of, but that's one of them. It's just so beautiful. And with a string arrangement.
What is your favorite scented candle?
I actually gave up scented candles for the oil diffusers. Anything calming.
Okay.
Anything calming.
What color is your soul?
I think it's a lot of colors. I don't think I can pick one.
Kaleidoscope.
Yeah.
What is one song you wish you had written?
Ugh, so many songs. I really cannot pick one. That's almost like the question, tell me about yourself. You know, there aren't very many. Give you a little more specific.
What kind of music do you like?
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. One of those questions. But, the thing that will come to my mind is probably a Beatles song. So I'm just going to say Help. But I would say also, it's not just the song, it's the recording of the song. So that, I wish I'd written it, but I also wish I'd sung it. I wish I had, that was my record. But enough about them.
What a perfect answer, though. Who is your celebrity crush?
I don't think I should say this because then I'm going to be typed. Someone's going to type me politically. But I do love Rachel Maddow. I think that she's so smart. And I just, I love her. And, I went through the pandemic with her on the screen. So I'm kind of partial to her. So I might, there's that celebrity crush. Let's see if I can think of another one that's not as, do they have to be alive? Because I have a lot of dead ones, Fred Astaire and.
Good one.
Yeah, I love all the dancers. I do love the dancers.
Okay, this is the last question. Who is your favorite Gilmore Girl?
So that has to be mother or daughter.
Or grandmother
or baby, perhaps. If there ever was to be a continuation. It's really hard not to love Lorelai. And I really think, I think Lauren is such a great actress. And maybe it's because when I was first doing the Gilmore Girls, it was maybe our first or second spotting session. I went to a coffee shop around the corner from Warner Brothers that's still there, Priscilla's, and was going in for coffee. And Lauren was dressed, I don't know if those were her real clothes or the Lorelai costume, but she was dressed just like Lorelai, and she was getting coffee. And I'd already seen, the episode, and I just thought it just seemed like, life was becoming art, or art was life, or something like that. It was funny. So maybe because of that, I also having, a child that I adore and love so much and am very good friends with and close to, having been a single mom become a single mom actually during the series and going through all that, sometimes I felt that the writers were really telling my story or reading my mail. And so I think, because of that, probably because I understand Lorelai's perspective.
All great answers during the lightning rounds.
Oh, good. Okay. Yeah.
Loved it. Everyone loved it.
Oh, good. And Doggy in the basement.
She is, you probably can't hear her, but
I can't
it
hear
sounds
her.
Like something is broken. So I have to go. But
yes,
Sam,
yes.
Thank you so much. This is so, I really enjoyed talking with you. And I'm looking forward to the new record, but take your time.
Thank you so much, Cindy. And I think maybe you've got some editing to do. I'm sorry if I rambled too much about the last thing we want to do is like make people fall asleep about, listening to stuff about mainline Christianity. It just doesn't seem like it's all the rage of topics to listen to on a show about music. So feel free.
This episode was produced by me, Cindy Howes. You can find Basic Folk on the Bluegrass Situation podcast network. You can search for Basic Folk on the SiriusXM app and listen there. Find us wherever you get podcasts or at our website, basicfolk.com. Thanks a lot for listening. Don't forget to tell a friend if you were like, this Sam Phillips interview was rad, and I think my friend Jamie would love it. Send it along to Jamie. Thanks for listening, and we'll talk to you next time. Bye.